Okay, well, welcome everybody. Do you care to take a seat at the back there, please? Good to see so many people have come out on a relatively cold night. Can the European Union survive? I implored a couple of friends of mine who've just come back from 2 months in Europe to come tonight. So they would find out the answer to that, and they said they've had been subjected to so many different opinions over the last 2 months that they thought they'd been saturated on this issue, so they haven't come. But you have. And we're, I guess, seeing the outcome of many years of European integration. It started after the Second World War, which I suppose you would say was a response in some ways to the geopolitical situation, and particularly the French desire to control German resurgence. And also, of course, moving into economic integration, which has been so important in reviving Western Europe, particularly in the period after the Second World War. And today we see all sorts of contradictory elements in the European project, including a list of countries that still wish to join, Croatia and maybe Serbia, Turkey very distantly possibly. On top of all of that is the serious problem of the Eurozone, the debt crisis in countries such as Greece and Portugal, maybe even Italy, and certainly Ireland. What's going to happen to that? And particularly central to a lot of this is the question of Germany's capacity, both politically, not so much economically, but politically, to continue to support the system. I'm very grateful to have Dr. Steffenauer from La Trobe University. He's talked to us before here, and some of you may have read his very interesting articles from time to time in The Australian. And he may explain this to you, but he is the Jean Monnet Chair of EU Interdisciplinary Studies at La Trobe, which is a very fine title, I think, given who Jean Monnet is. But I'll let him explain that. So we're very grateful to have you, Stefan, and to hear your latest take on the European situation.
Thanks, Tim, for your kind introduction and, in fact, for the invitation to speak here tonight. I find it a daunting challenge, but I'm also very much looking forward to think through some of the key issues that have preoccupied me, and very much looking forward to hearing your opinions on that, because, to be honest, I'm not going to give you the ultimate answer to that big question. I just hope I'll raise a couple of intelligent questions that will complicate that question further. As to my title, I am indeed a proud holder of the Jean Monnet Chair, which is an initiative funded by the European Union that supports educational activities on the basis that the more you know about the European Union, the more you will end up loving it. It didn't quite work out that way for me. This is not to say that I am skeptical about the EU as such, and I hope I'll explain my position towards the end of this paper. But I think the problems that the EU is facing today are hugely significant. And I also strongly believe that the responses that have been adopted over the last year and a half are not helping in dealing with those problems. And reflecting on my own career, I think it's kind of ironic that I started teaching and researching the EU 10 years ago. I was appointed a college lecturer at the Dublin European Institute at the University College Dublin. I spent 5 years in Dublin experiencing the Celtic Tiger there. And it was roughly at the same time that the EU kind of launched a number of very ambitious initiatives, including the common European currency, that I think in hindsight proved fatally wrong. Too ambitious, basically. These initiatives were driven by the strong belief you know, some academics put it that Europe would run the 21st century, you know, so sky was the limit. And why not having a United States of Europe underpinned by the common currency? And I think that the whole process was pushed too fast, and the challenge is basically to wind it down a bit. But that is my view, and I hope I'll be able to elaborate on it. I think the challenges that Europe are facing are difficult to comprehend. Now, I should admit that I am not an economist by training. I did my PhD in politics. My appointment is shared between history and politics, and my presentation is an attempt at understanding. And I love literature. I think we can learn about politics by reading great novels. So I shall start with Anna Karenina, because there is a marvelous dialogue in Anna Karenina that I think describes the current predicament that Europeans face better than anyone. So there is Leonid Nikolaevich Tolstoy and his view of Europe. Anna has a problem, as you know, those of you who read Karenina. She is in love, but in love with the wrong man. You know, she is a quintessentially modern woman. She is glamorous. She is successful. She is married to a very successful man. She is admired, but she wants to have it all, and she wants more. She wants true love too, yeah? And so she falls in love with the wrong man, not her husband, Vronsky. And she complains about her husband to her brother or friend, I can't even remember. She says, "I have heard it said that women love men even for their vices, but I hate him for his virtues. I can't live with him. Would you believe it, that knowing he is a good man, a splendid man, that I'm not worth his little finger, still I hate him. I hate him for his generosity." Germany is the virtuous husband, and passionate though misguided, Anna is Greece, or if you want, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, Spain, the list goes on, of course. Germany is feared, respected, and despised for its virtues and generosity. The fact that Anna's husband is right doesn't make it easier for her to accept his solutions. On the contrary, it makes it difficult for her, impossible. And in a similar way, German prescriptions to the Greek crisis might be correct, factually, but that doesn't make them acceptable. Germany might be right, but it has no right to be right. Historically, of course, it's the last nation in Europe that can tell others how to conduct their business. Its policies towards Greece and other struggling European nations smack of foreign domination. What is lost in the EU approach to its sovereign debt crisis is democratic legitimacy, which is a problem that Europe has faced for decades, but that has been dramatically increased through the Eurozone crisis. Greece, that likes to see itself as the birthplace of European democracy, is serving as a stage for its undoing. A nation that no longer appears to be in charge of its own destiny, Greece is forced to endure public humiliation by using its democratic instruments in crude violation of its democratic spirit. Now, for those of you who read Anna Karenina, you know about her solution. It's suicide. That's one way of reclaiming control over your destiny when there is no other way. Committing suicide. I'm not suggesting that is the Greek solution. I'm not suggesting anything at this stage. But the tension that I tried to sketch is not just invented. Yeah, these are examples from mainstream media. Yeah, the German monthly, The Focused, describing the Greeks as the liars in the Euro family, and in turn Greek media invoking the trauma of German domination. Now, I don't want to overstate that problem. I think at this stage my research assistant, who reads Greek, tells me at this stage there is not that much anti-German sentiment that evokes these nasty images. But for me, this is bad enough, considering that the situation can only get worse still. So I just have a couple of images of demonstrations that show that the EU is obviously no longer popular. And I think that is a very serious problem. Like, the EU struggled in terms of gaining democratic legitimacy amongst the peoples of Europe, even in good times. In bad times, I think this is getting only worse. And then in terms of there being the right set of kind of policies or solutions for the Greek problem, the legitimacy matters. I think that even with the International Monetary Fund, often the experience has been made that you impose a set of policies on the country. If they are not seen as legitimate, then they just won't work. Yeah, and this problem in Greece is pretty serious. You see, I read German media quite regularly, and I saw an interview with Swedish finance minister who said, look, Greeks can easily solve their problems, they should just follow what we have done, increase taxes and cut the expenditure. Yeah? That is the prescription, in fact, that is being imposed on Greece. But Sweden is perhaps the only country on earth where you can actually get more money by increasing taxes. Because in other countries, particularly when they are economically struggling, what you will end up getting is, lessening of the economic activities, but also stronger incentives for avoiding paying taxes. So you need the kind of public spirit that underpins a functioning taxation regime that Greece doesn't quite have. And when the measures are seen as illegitimate, then it's just made worse. So this is a recent demonstration of I don't pay movement in Greece that publicly states that they would defy those demands. And this, to me, is the scariest picture, actually, that I found. But again, I can only hope that it's not all that representative. Mind you, when I researched for this paper, I was in Warsaw. And, Warsaw is one of those cities where you cannot escape the terrible history of Europe, because obviously that was the city that was damaged more than any other city in Europe during the Second World War. So the trauma is kind of still there. Like, I actually stayed in the old city center, but that the old city center is not as old as it's meant to look. It was all built in the 50s, so there is a kind of fake feel about it. And so you just cannot escape history. And I thought, gosh, it's so lucky that Poles can feel reasonably confident about their fortune, their destiny. They are doing quite well economically, and importantly, they are outside of the Eurozone. I was thinking to myself, if Poles found themselves in the situation that Greece is in today, or Ireland, I would dread the prospect of similar symbols on the streets of Warsaw. Yeah? I would find even more scary. So Greeks have their trauma of the Second World War, but I suppose in comparison with, say, Poland, also because of the size of Poland and the symbolic value of Polish-German relationship, that currently is pretty healthy. I think that is something to consider, that the Eurozone was meant to cement the kind of brotherhood of nations of Europe, and it brought about exactly the opposite. It is increasing the latent hostilities amongst the nations of Europe, and that, to me, is a massive political failure that no one can deny. But how did we get there? How did we get here? That is kind of one of the biggest paradoxes of the Eurozone. The common currency was basically imposed on Germany by the French when the prospect of German unification occurred after the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989. And there was a fear in Europe, not only in France, in Britain too, in other countries, in Poland, everywhere, that Germany would become too powerful and too dominant in Europe. And the solution that politicians pursued was the one that was used in Europe before, even immediately after the Second World War. In fact, that is one of the key rationales for the project of European unity, to embed Germany in European structures. And so it was believed that through the creation of a common currency, Germany would become more European. Yeah? Now, Germans in turn were offered the prospect of a currency that would be as stable, as reliable, and as trustworthy as their beloved German mark used to be. Yeah, that was the deal. And that deal was implemented through the Treaty of Maastricht that created the legal kind of conditions for the common currency and the way it should work. And that was, in a sense, a European solution to the German question that presented itself anew through the possibility of German reunification. But the paradoxical result of this project 20 years later is that the German question presents itself anew when Germany became by far the strongest economic power in Europe and when Germany is becoming reluctantly a hegemonic power. Germans don't want to rule Europe, but they are, that's the only country that has the money to rescue the Eurozone, and therefore it also is forced to take more responsibility for the problems of the Eurozone. I suppose that the question one could ask therefore is, who changed more, Germany or Europe? Yeah? They both changed dramatically over the last 20 years, and I think how German relationship to Europe can be reconciled with the changing Europe is one of the key questions that will decide the fate of the Eurozone. So Germany is at the center of it, as everyone knows, but as I pointed out, what is kind of scary is that it puts Germany on a collision course with the rest of Europe. You see, until quite recently, there was a perfect fit between Germany's self-understanding and its ambitions in Europe and the wider world, and Europe at large, yeah? Even with the Eurozone, for example. The Germans have a very strong sense of obeying by the rules. And so the Eurozone was established through a firm set of rules, the so-called Maastricht criteria. Yeah? It was meant to work because all the member states would simply comply with the basic set of fiscal rules. The budget deficit would never be higher than 3% and the overall debt would never be higher than 60%. We know, of course, that even France and Germany violated against those rules in 2005 or 6, so the whole edifice was weakened through that. And now we know that hardly any country in the Eurozone actually still lives up to those demands. So the EU is increasingly resembling Belgium, where you have rising hostilities that are caused by the sense of envy or unfair treatment or whatever, where the more prosperous regions are made responsible for the less wealthy regions. But of course, in response to the crisis, I mean, these are statements actually even from last year, the EU elites, including national leaders like Sarkozy or Merkel or the EU Commission, expressed the determination to do whatever it takes to defend the Eurozone. And my suggestion is that this determination actually made the problems worse rather than helping to solve them. Yeah, I thought already in May last year that it would have been preferable to focus on the rescue of the European Union rather than the rescue of the Eurozone in its current form. I argued already in May last year that Europe might have been better off bribing Greece into exiting the Eurozone than desperately trying to keep it in it. Now, the arguments in favor of the bailout last year were that that was necessary to prevent contagion from happening. Yeah? That was one of the key arguments in favor of it. And we know that that failed, because since then, two more countries had to be bailed out, Ireland and Portugal. And now two more countries are potentially in similar difficulties. So that policy didn't work even economically. And politically, it certainly exacerbated the situation in all the key member states. This is what I mean, that nobody is happy. The Greeks are not happy because they feel they fear German domination, and Germans are not happy because they feel that they shouldn't be paying for Greeks. I mean, I just spent a couple of days in Berlin, and I found it fascinating because I was kind of fortunate enough to be able to be in two different worlds. I met some very influential people, including the former foreign minister Joschka Fischer, who is still highly respected as a politician and a public figure. And people like Joschka Fischer are committed even more than ever to the ideal of a United States of Europe. And they believe that that's the only way to address the Eurozone crisis, that the European Commission will be turned into a proper government and the European Parliament into a proper parliament. Yeah? And when you speak to people on the street, like in cafes, in pubs, when you speak to taxi drivers, and I talk to everyone I could, then you get a completely different message. People are absolutely scathing about the policies that the government has been pursuing, and they're scathing about the idea that they should be bailing out Greece. Now, when you think that it might be unfair for people in the wealthier member states to bail out Greece, and I think that can be a valid argument, because you see, they had to cut their expenditure and their welfare state had to be reduced, etc. So in the local communities you see that money is not quite there. I spoke to people in West Berlin who complained that all the money went to East Berlin and they have nothing, yeah? Which is probably inaccurate, but that's what they said, that was the perception. When you think of Germans complaining, think of Slovaks actually, because Slovakia, it's a paradoxical case within the Eurozone. Slovakia is still the poorest country of the Eurozone in terms of per capita GDP, by far the poorest country. But it has solid public finances. Its debt is only 43%. Well, it's huge for Australian standards, but in Europe that makes you look like you are a star performer. That's only half of what the German debt is, yeah? 40%, 43% of its yearly GDP. That means that Slovakia, Slovaks, or Slovak taxpayers, are of course asked to contribute to those rescue efforts for Greece or Ireland. And that is quite absurd, of course, because Ireland, and I even had the chance to visit Ireland now a few weeks ago, Ireland still is one of the richest countries on earth in terms of the average GDP, per capita GDP, or people's income. Yeah? It still is a very wealthy country. It just has a massive sovereign debt, as we know. But so, in terms of the talk of pan-European or supranational solidarity, I think those arguments are not sufficiently convincing. But let me go back to Germany, because I think Germany, in the end, is the crucial factor how Germany will deal with that crisis. I said before, and this is an observation actually by someone who is much more optimistic about the Eurozone. In fact, Mark Leonard is the author of the book that I mentioned in the opening remarks, Why Europe Will Rule the 21st Century. And even Mark Leonard observes that there is a growing tension between the way in which Germany once saw the EU as the embodiment of post-war German virtues, such as fiscal rectitude, stability and consensus, they now see it as a threat to those same virtues. Whereas many Europeans want Germany to save Europe, many Germans now want to be saved from Europe. I strongly believe that that is one of the keys to understand the success of the post-war reconstruction of democracy in Germany. Not just economic reconstruction, the post-war reconstruction of democracy, that it was embedded in the European structures. It built on the kind of pre-existing sentiment of people that the rules matter, yeah? And so there was a very strong Rechtsstaat, the state of law, yeah? A democratic Rechtsstaat, state of law. And this understanding of German interests and German commitments as being aligned with Europe has been compromised, because a number of those policies that have been adopted and that European politicians had to be adopted, the Berlin had to be adopted to address the Eurozone crisis, basically fudged the rules. The Maastricht Treaty that created the legal framework for the common European currency stipulated explicitly, at least that is what the Germans were told, that there will be no bailout that one country will not stand for the debts of another country. Now this is being disputed amongst lawyers, but the German voters were told in no uncertain terms that that is going to be the case. The Germans were basically sold the project of the common currency as, look, we will just have a German mark that will be extended over the whole of Europe. Even the seat of the European Central Bank was located in Frankfurt, which symbolically, of course, had tremendous importance. Was of tremendous importance. Now, what's the way out of this? As I mentioned already, I have a sense that the German elites, perhaps including the German government, though the German government will be more cautious than, say, Jürgen Habermas, one of the leading German public intellectuals and philosopher, or Joschka Fischer, I already mentioned. And then people within the European Commission, like the President of the European Commission, President Barroso, or in fact, I just read an article yesterday by George Soros, well, how should I describe it? A philanthropist and a very successful speculator. I value his philanthropy. He created a university in Budapest. These people argue that what Europe needs is more integration. Yeah? And the argument has its own logic. I just think that that logic doesn't work. But it is plausible. The logic is, what happened with the Treaty of Maastricht and with the introduction of the common currency is that an ambitious step was made, but it was a step that required further steps. Yeah? So economic integration was pushed forward before political integration occurred, and what the crisis shows is that more political integration is needed. So people like Joschka Fischer are adamant that the only way to deal with the crisis is to create a true federation of nation states, a true United States of Europe, where redistribution of resources will occur as a matter of fact. There won't be constant hackering about them. Yeah? They will just agree, for example, on Eurobonds, issuing Eurobonds, whereby it will no longer matter whether you are Germany or Greece when you want to raise revenue. Yeah? That is one vision. To realign that ambitious project of the common currency with more ambitious political integration. I think that that proposition is fallacious because people no longer support that. I mean, people are not supportive of it even 5 years ago. You know, the constitutional treaty that was adopted by the heads of states and government in 2004 was rejected in a public referendum in France and in the Netherlands. And I think that rejection had many various reasons, but one of them was the sense of Europe being pushed too far, too fast. Yeah? So now to say that we need to go even further, when the European public opinion, whenever it had a chance to voice that opinion, was totally against it. I think it's fallacious. In terms of democratic legitimacy, it's a non-starter. So the other option that I listed there is partial retreat back to nature, reclaim some democracy at the nation-state level and accept that the partial dismemberment of the Eurozone will be necessary. Now, there should be no doubt that this path would be also incredibly painful, messy and ugly. Yeah? The simple fact of the matter is that there is no neat way out of this crisis. I just think there are less bad ways, and to me that option would be less damaging medium long term than to continue pushing forward against the public opinion, or in fact against increasingly advice of economists and other specialized observers. And what I find fascinating actually, and that is a more kind of perhaps theoretical problem that I don't need to discuss here all that much, what I find fascinating is that the question of national sovereignty presents itself anew and in a new light. Because having taught the EU subject to my undergraduate students for the last 5 or 10 years, you see, that is a kind of textbook wisdom that you will find everywhere, that the EU found a solution to the problem of national sovereignty by transcending it or sharing it or whatever. Yeah, and there are all these beautiful, complicated concepts that I can explain to my students. But I think those concepts are only credible in good times. In good times, it's all nice to be Irish and European, and to be empowered as an Irishman through being European, because a small member state has indeed a lot to gain from being a part of a bigger family of nations. Yeah? That story is perfectly plausible. In good times, but in bad times, when you no longer have control over your national destiny, and the question presents itself anew in a very dramatic way. For me, this is the contest that Europe is undergoing now. Where will sovereignty be shifted? You see, the people arguing in favor of realignment are basically saying that the sovereignty has to move to the national level. I would repatriate it, to the supranational European level. Well, I would repatriate it to the national level. And I suppose the people on the streets of Athens would also try to repatriate it, well, even further below, because they are fed up with the politicians. But I don't know, I would leave it there. So the question is basically who prevails. And that is also an argument, actually, that is occurring in the German context, and it has been occurring in the German context for the last two decades, ever since the Maastricht Treaty was adopted. And one of the key players in that contest is the German Constitutional Court. So there is an interesting potential clash of titans that might occur, because the German Constitutional Court, on a number of occasions, in relation to the Maastricht Treaty and more recently to the Lisbon Treaty, and then for those of you who are interested, there were some decisions even before then, the German Constitutional Court has attempted on a number of occasions to set the limits to the project of supranational Europe. One of the key arguments used in their argumentation was that the peoples of Europe don't constitute the demos, yeah, and therefore to protect democracy in Germany, it is important to protect it at the national level, and so that you can only go that far when moving competencies to the supranational level. And that reasoning has now been actually used by a number of people who raised objections against the very first Eurozone rescue effort from last year. And there is some of the reasoning, I think, for an outsider, is quite intriguing, you know. I suspect that Germany might be the only country on earth where you can demand from your constitutional court, when you consider that to be your constitutional right, that your currency will not become inflationary. One of the claims that the people now challenging that decision are making is that the efforts for the rescue of the Eurozone might prove inflationary, and that basically undermines the right to property. Yeah? And that is a serious argument in the German context, because in the German context, the threat of inflation has the trauma attached to it, that is the Weimar Republic, its failure, and the Nazi takeover that followed. So again, we are back to the idea of political culture being hugely important. Yeah? And this is, to me, something that became evident through the crisis of the Eurozone. That 10 years ago, even I thought that, well, the Eurozone, why couldn't it work? Like, Europe was unified, and I benefited from it when traveling across Europe. And I heard arguments on both sides, economists arguing in favor or against the Eurozone. I can see that those arguing against it were proven right. But one thing that has not been covered all that much, even in the media and commentaries and all that, is the importance of political culture. So that if, you know, if Europeans really turned all into Germans, then you could have a common currency, no matter whether you are in Athens or Brussels, yeah? But they're not. They're not going to. Greeks will not love paying taxes just because the European Commission tells them to do so. So, another way of looking at the current problem is to ask, what kind of currency the euro will become? You know? Will it become German, as Germans were promised initially through the Maastricht Treaty? You know? That is German meaning fiscal discipline, low inflation, commitment to rules,
Yeah? And the independence of the European Central Bank. Because the German Bundesbank was independent, and that independence served Germans well. Well, it doesn't look like it's going to be German. The candidate for the... the might have been president of the European Central Bank, Axel Weber, is no longer available for that job. And that's quite interesting, because he's no longer available for that job because he made himself hugely unpopular by objecting to certain policies that the European Central Bank followed, pursued, which compromised its independence. They accepted to buy Greek bonds on the secondary markets, which is problematic according to this view of how a central bank should operate, being independent from political pressures. So will the euro become more French? Now, I don't want to push this. This is just a metaphor. I don't want to push it as kind of national prejudice. This is a metaphor, though, that serves a good purpose, because the point I try to make is that the currency is also a reflection of various political cultures. And the French have different idea about what role the state should play in the economy. And the French are more at ease with the interference of the government in the policies of the central bank. So Jean-Claude Trichet, who is the outgoing president of the European Central Bank, pursued certain policies that Weber found problematic, because, as I said, they compromise the independence of the central bank. I mean, I didn't quite understand it fully when it occurred, what's the big deal. But now, when Greece is about to default on its debt, I understand it better, because the fact that the European Central Bank owns Greek bonds makes it very vulnerable. That is why the European Central Bank now objects against involving private bondholders in the bailout, because it will have to write off that fictitious money that it doesn't have. And when it writes off that fictitious money, then that money has to be replaced. And then Germany and other members of the Eurozone will be asked to put in real money into the European Central Bank to recapitalize it, which will be painful. Then you will have German newspapers writing how much an individual German is now paying for the mistakes of their politicians and for the stuff-ups of Greece. That is one version. Another version might be another solution. I'll just come to it. Will the euro become German after all? This is not a mistake. Mario Draghi sounds like an Italian name. He's in fact Italian. But this is not a joke. When his candidature first was mooted as a possibility, when it became clear that Axel Weber was no longer available, the German media, and not just the Bild-Zeitung, the kind of populist press, serious newspapers like the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, described Draghi as a kind of German central banker. We can trust this guy. He's serious about low inflation. Yeah? He's serious about low inflation, and he will pursue policies that are compatible with the way in which the European Central Bank is meant to operate. But he might not be able to do so. And this is why I suggest that that might be the third option, that the euro will indeed become more Italian. And you see, this is not a kind of attempt to make racist claims about Italian people, and I love Italy, I even started learning Italian. It is just to point out again that different political cultures create different currencies. Italians were able to live with their lira, yeah? That had many zeros. They might not have loved it, but they were quite comfortable with it. Germans would never have accepted, German democracy would have been threatened if they had the currency as unreliable as lira was after the Second World War, because the trauma of the hyperinflation was so strong. So if that ends up to be the path that the Eurozone takes, then you can expect Germans not to be very happy with that outcome, because that would be the path that would lead to higher inflation. And when I said that scenario, that Greece is forced to default on its debt, the European Central Bank is probably now the largest bondholder of Greek debt, well, it wouldn't have to ask for more cash from the member states. It would just fudge it.
It would, that is called monetary easing, I think, or there is a sophisticated term for it. It will just print money. But that obviously will increase inflation. So we are back to Germany and the existentialist struggle that German politicians have to pursue. I suppose I will just restate my point as a concluding remark, that I think it would be vastly preferable for the EU elites and national politicians to accept that the Eurozone in its current form is a failed project and focus their energy on rescuing the European Union. Because by saying things like the rescue of the Eurozone is vital for the survival of the European Union, they are undoing the European Union and potentially causing more harm than helping it. Thanks for your attention.
Well, I'm not sure after that whether the European Union is going to survive or not, but yes.
I'm just wondering if it possibly can, because all of these bailouts seem to be very short-sighted. They don't provide for the countries that they're bailed out to actually be able to pay back later on. They just seem to be quite destructive. So the system has to collapse sooner or later, doesn't it?
Well, I really think that, like, for a country like Greece, there's just no way it can get out of it within the constraints of the Eurozone. Because it's the problem they have is not just that they don't have enough cash. They just are not competitive, yeah? And they cannot devalue the currency, obviously. So as long as they are stuck within the Eurozone, they will not become competitive. Ireland, for example, is quite different. I understand that I spoke to my former colleagues there just a few weeks ago, and I understand that the industry sector in Ireland that is directed more towards export is actually booming and doing quite well. So Ireland, of all the struggling countries, might be the only one that might even manage to recover from within the Eurozone. I already noticed also in Ireland that there was what economists call internal devaluation, which is very painful. And I suspect, I don't know, again, for some weird cultural reasons, Irish are probably better equipped or more willing to accept internal devaluation than Greeks. I mean, for non-economists, internal devaluation basically means that your salary will be lower, yeah, and you'll get more money. But ideally, the services and the stuff you need to buy will get cheaper. And in Ireland, it has occurred. Like, even like going out for meals, it used to be prohibitively expensive in Ireland, and these days one no longer feels like a beggar in Dublin. So there is some difference there, but they have still a long way to go. If I stayed in Ireland, I lived there from 2001 to 2006, and I left Ireland in 2006 to take on this job in La Chope that I love. But if I stayed there, my salary, my Irish salary, would still have been higher today than my Australian salary, even though I was promoted in the meantime and everything. They still have some of the highest salaries. My academic colleagues still have some of the highest salaries in Europe. And they had to accept like 10-15% cuts, and these are the kind of absurdities of the Eurozone that cannot be easily solved within the constraints of the Eurozone. There is a German economist or industrialist who published a book, Henkel, arguing that what is needed is to turn, to split the Eurozone into two, to create a kind of hard euro that would serve the interests of the northern countries well, and then a weaker euro for the more struggling economies. I don't know whether that proposition is plausible. I know for sure that one aspect of his proposition is not feasible, and that is he suggested that France should be put into that weaker group and considering how vital the project of Franco-German reconciliation is for the whole project of European unity, that's a complete non-starter. But I think there is just no way around accepting that the Eurozone in its current form cannot survive. So it will be messy, you know. Undoing it will be messy, but I just can't see how they can. Yeah, I could relate again to Tolstoy. There are two sentences I forgot about. Anna's death in Tolstoy's novel is tragic, unavoidable, but beautiful. That's what you also get in opera. Yeah, it's so beautiful to die in an opera. Yeah, the demise of the European project will be ugly, but it is still avoidable. I do believe that it is avoidable. They just need to start addressing real problems. I have the feeling that they live in denial, that it's like a gambler. You just double the bet and you will win. So last year the package they agreed on was worth $1 trillion Australian dollars. I reckon in a couple of days we will hear they will quadruple it or something. What? 1 trillion? 4 trillion, or whatever, and we'll get there.
The gentleman there.
I'm a member of the Institute. My question is about the increasing sovereign debts in both Europe and virtually every other Western country. Mm. I understand that in virtually every Western culture, there is an exponential increase of unproductive, highly fertile people who need or even demand full state support. Mm. Is this the main, if not the only, cause of the exponential increase of financial problems?
Mm. Well, I do think that the crisis of sovereign debt is also the crisis of the welfare state, and that's probably the direction your question is going to. But I think, well, I don't know. I don't know enough about the United States, and of course their level of debt is in total, I think, even higher in proportion of their GDP than the whole of Eurozone. But there is still one difference that I think is quite significant, and that is that Americans are still in charge of their destiny. Yeah? So, I mean, they might stuff up monumentally and they might even default on their debt in a couple of weeks or whatever, but it's their choice, and I think that is what is so hugely problematic in Europe, that who is in charge of the destiny of Greece or the destiny of the Eurozone? You know, like that is where also the governing structures of the European Union are so complex that I just don't know how that can ever be addressed accurately. So I think that is still a difference, because like with Americans, it's their currency, yeah? So like I understand, like they can slightly inflate it, and maybe the debt will be reduced. They have to reform the welfare state so that it's sustainable. And but you know, you also kind of hinted at the problem of demographics, and I think that is much more pronounced in continental Europe than in the Anglosphere. And when you talked about unproductive or people don't have children, basically. Yeah? It's more a problem in continental Europe. Or you meant people are out of work?
Unproductive people. And yeah, it's increasing in every Western culture, and particularly in Australia. In Australia, I've been particularly interested in that. I wrote a paper on it. Mm-hmm. Nobody would touch it.
No.
America published it straight away because the welfare scene here mirrors that in virtually every Western culture.
Yeah.
And it's the exponential increase in people who need full support, who are unproductive.
Mm. I don't know enough about that problem, but I read a couple of papers that pointed out that most of the Western countries, including Germany actually, have amassed so many obligations that they are virtually bankrupt anyway. So this is the other absurdity, that Germany is taking on more obligations, and it will not even be able to serve its own
obligations towards its own population. That is, I think, quite clear. I mean, I even read papers by left-wing economists who are supportive of the welfare state pointing out that fact. You know, when people refer to 80% debt in relation to German GDP, then the real kind of debt, I understand, is three times higher if you also take into consideration the payments that the state will have to do for public servants who retire, etc. So the situation is pretty dire. I think Australia is a lucky country.
I read a book by Sarrazin,
yes.
The book, and he's particularly worried about the mass immigration of low income, or at least no income, highly fertile.
Well, Sarrazin's book has its problems, though. I don't know whether I should
take a question from this.
If one characterises the Eurozone as the players in it foregoing some level of economic sovereignty, foregoing some of that for safety, if it proves to be a failure in Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, is this not fertile ground for right-wing movements in Europe? And fertile ground for the re-establishment of kind of ultra-nationalist political movements in Europe? Is that one of the scenarios?
Well, absolutely. I totally agree. And that is why I would also... am kind of despairing at the failure of mainstream politicians to address some of the very genuine concerns that, say, people in Germany, France or Greece have, because it will support the extreme right. The funny thing is, in Germany at this stage, there is still no political party, mainstream or whatever, on the margins, that would openly advocate an exit from the Eurozone, or that would openly voice views that are highly critical of the European Union. But I suspect even that can change at the moment when it occurs that there is real money that will be paid. You see, that the funny thing about all these rescue efforts is that all these sums have been thrown around like $1 trillion and all that. But German politicians are still able to say at this stage that none of that money is for real. They are just guarantees, Some real money had to be already put in some of those rescue funds, but mostly it's just guarantees, and that, you know, money is lent to Greece. But when Greece defaults and it becomes obvious that it is really costly, then I think the public opinion will
I suppose if you look at the European economies, I don't know whether it's absolutely true, but the German economy is still a massive balance of payments surplus. It's still, until recently, I think, the largest exporter in the world of manufactured goods. It's the only one accumulating reserves that can at the end of the day provide the financial, the real advances to other countries, to other European countries.
Well, I mean, in German debates, the people who defend financial transfers and support of Greece and all that point out, rightly to some extent, that Germany is a major beneficiary of the Eurozone. And in fact, that is one of the paradoxes of the current crisis, that it pushes the euro down. And that makes German exports... if Germans had the German mark... for Germany, the currency is undervalued, while for Greece, it's massively overvalued, or for Ireland. But you see, again, I mean, to me, that argument doesn't quite work, because I simply cannot see how you could have in Europe nations that are doomed to be permanently on the periphery. Like, we have to accept it reluctantly in Australia that Bendigo, that was a century ago an immensely rich city, is now, I hope there are not too many people from Bendigo here, is now not as rich, And it's even more the case of some of the more remote regions. And then we accept transfers between the centers and regions in Australia, and we accept also that some of these places will never be as important as they used to be. But will Greeks ever fully come to terms with the fact that there will be just a kind of EU protectorate somewhere there, nowhere, with their Acropolis, not able to live from their own means? There is just no way I can see that as a sustainable.
Another quick, yes.
I'm Gwyneth Benjamin, a member of the Institute. Could you tell us a little bit more about modern day Belgium? After all, the EU started in Brussels, Berlin, and we had wonderful friends who always said to us, we were the first Europeans. We have had the Spanish, the Austrians, etc. Could you give us something on modern day Belgium?
Well, I don't know whether I know enough about modern day in Belgium. In fact, I visited Brussels only twice, and it feels quite surreal, Brussels, and that kind of interesting reflection of the EU, because it has a city within the city which makes you feel like you are on a different planet, seriously. Like, when you go and visit some of the EU institutions, you really live in a different universe there. But Belgium itself, well, it's an interesting example, because again, to me, it shows that in good times, you can have it all. You can have a kind of multinational democracy that works. Because in good times, you have a problem and you throw money at that problem and you will pacify the people who are suffering under that problem, which is what the Belgians have done with their ethnic diversity. And I don't know enough about that history, but at one stage Walloons were richer than the other group, then the fortunes changed. But there is always resentment when these kind of transfers occur. And those resentments are just increased dramatically in bad times, yeah? as is Belgium experiencing now. And Belgium also has about 100% of GDP level of debt. And what I find astonishing is, like, whenever I ask people, I was in Belgium last year, and I ask young people in the pub, you know, like, are you not worried about that? Young people should worry more than anyone. Yeah? That is their debt, basically. They're completely relaxed about it. That is where I sometimes even wonder whether Australians are more aware of economic implications of what your government does, because most people have mortgages or something, I don't know. In Europe, the dependence on state is higher, and then perhaps also the feeling that it's not your worry or your business is stronger. I had a similar experience in Italy. I spoke to the member of Italian Parliament last year, and he assured me that the Italian debt was not a problem because they have had the same level of debt for the last decade, which is roughly also about 100%. And I thought, that's an interesting reasoning. And you have had it for a decade and it didn't matter, so it doesn't matter. And we know today, of course, that it doesn't quite work that way, because it does matter a great deal today.
Matthew Doyle from Monash University. Stefan, thank you very much for your talk and for your analysis of what I think is really the tragedy of the Pyrrhic victory. The Pyrrhic victory, which is when the French won the Euro as a way to tie Germany back in. But what they lost is that obviously the Euro was in fact Deutschmark. Germany was able to impose its conditions and, as you said, project its own very specific political culture. Economic, the political culture that conditions its approach to monetary issues. There's lots to say. You've said a lot. You know, the situation can be complex. But something that struck me in your account of this tragedy is there is a missing actor. You have not mentioned it, and the old lefty in me comes out, meaning that there is another actor in that tragedy, and these are the global financial markets.
The global markets, yeah, the nasty global markets. That's true.
Because when the German, you know, average voter complains that Germany is bailing out Greece, that's not entirely correct. What they are bailing out are the French and German banks. Right? And that's why they have been, you know, trying to stop. This is the real threat. That their banks will be terribly affected by this situation, because the structural imbalances of the eurozone, which you talked about, have made the eurozone incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah.
In view of the fact that, as you mentioned, that the Central European Bank gave up those instruments of political sovereignty, don't even say that it's national sovereignty, political sovereignty, which the American federal Reserve Bank has, right? European states within the Eurozone are forced to borrow from the private financial markets. They cannot go directly to the European Central Bank. They've got to go to the financial markets, which then borrow from the European Central Bank.
Maybe
to wrap up, can you add a little bit about that?
Yes, I didn't talk about the global markets, good point, and the major omission. I didn't talk about the global markets because I think that we just live in a... I'm not an old lefty. I believe that we live in a free world and that that is the only way. And the fact that the global markets are fickle, as they are, is just tough luck. Because the alternative that was tried for decades in Eastern Europe didn't deliver better results, and I could have said that actually in the introduction. I'm originally from communist Czechoslovakia, and that was truly an alternative model to control the markets. In fact, one could even, I mean, I don't want to push it too far, but when Angela Merkel says that we have to assert the control over markets, then it kind of reminds me of that logic. I think my view is that we have to accept that global markets are fickle, which is not to say that we accept that we are powerless. But what matters then is who is seen as being in charge. That matters a great deal. And that is where I learned something from Friedrich von Hayek. Yeah? That if you are a victim of an abstract force like the nasty capitalist global market, then you can probably better accept it. And you shouldn't accept it. You should start again or whatever. But it's easier to accept it than if you are a victim of a bureaucrat who decides that your job is no longer needed and therefore you should drop dead. Yeah, and that is a major psychological aspect that actually applies to the Eurozone crisis, because it would be easier for Greeks to accept the tough luck of the global market the way Argentina had to accept it, or Indonesia, or whatever country that went through similar difficulties, than to accept that German finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble decides what and how and when we should do. Or President Barroso, the president of the European Commission, decides what and how and when we should do. You see, that is what frightens me. I mean, even the Nazis were appalled by the fickleness of the global markets, and they identify them with the Jews. It's the Jews who are destroying Germany, you know? And to me, I mean, this is, I don't want to push it too far, but there is a very serious danger when you can identify actors, even persons, and I know that in Greece there are posters in these demonstrations that claim that Sarkozy and Merkel are fascists, yeah? It's absurd. Like it's utterly absurd, considering that Merkel is desperate to get enough public support in Germany to support Greece. But you know, that is where I think a more kind of humble acceptance of the vicissitudes of the global markets would actually serve European interests.
We're running out a bit short in time.
Jeffrey, I've got just two quick questions. What does this do to the admission of Turkey into the Union? And who is the current rotating president of a country in charge of the Union for the next 6 months? And do they have the capability to make a difference?
Well, I mean, there was an enlargement fatigue in Europe even before the Eurozone crisis occurred. So Turkish membership, I don't think is going to happen anytime soon. In fact, there are indications that it has been deferred massively because there is budgetary planning that is taking place kind of almost a decade ahead, and it's not being planned for Turkish membership. So I don't see that happening anytime soon. And the other question was about the presidency, which is now in Poland, actually. Well, you know that through the Lisbon Treaty, the role of the presidency has been reduced, but that didn't prevent Poles from getting very excited about having it, because it has a great kind of symbolic value. And I was in Warsaw on the first day of presidency, so there were great kind of public celebrations of it and stuff. And I know that one of the key motives that the Poles want to kind of push other Europeans to accept is the one of solidarity. But I find it quite amusing because the Poles love the concept of European solidarity because at the moment they are the biggest one of the biggest recipients of transfers and stuff. So there were demonstrations also in Warsaw against that rhetoric by people in Poland who feel forgotten, disadvantaged, the welfare state doesn't look after them. So
maybe one more question, sir.
Quick question. Wouldn't it help if the Greeks actually paid their taxes?
They would.
Seriously, I've read that only 30% of the corporations in Greece pay tax, and probably less of the individuals.
Yes, that's a perfect point. How do you make them pay taxes? You see, that I think Greece can only be saved by Greeks. That would be my point. Yeah. To think that the European Commission or Angela Merkel or President Sarkozy can change the way in which Greeks pay or don't pay taxes, I think that is one of the fallacies that is also implied in the idea of a United States of Europe. You know, you would have an economic government based somewhere in Brussels or God knows what. How will they ever accomplish that very difficult challenge? You know, one way might be the way that Slovaks did it. Slovakia has flat taxation, which is not something I would advocate for Australia. I believe that progressive taxation is meaningful. But it's only meaningful when it works. Yeah? And Greek opposition party actually advocated that, but they are isolated in the conservative party for obvious reasons. So I don't know.
Well, Stefan, thank you very much. I've heard Stefan speak before, and I knew that he would be very interesting, and particularly he's always very engaging. And I think it reflects your background, if I may say so, Central European intellectual, very much in that tradition. Talking to Stefan before the talk this morning, I don't know whether you wish this to be repeated, but when I asked about the survival of the European Union, he said, "I'm not an economist, but I think that the better guides are from fiction." And you mentioned some particular novelist that I'd not heard of. You might. Who was that? You don't recall. But I did enjoy very much the way you wove into your discussion some of the literature.
I mentioned Dostoevsky, actually. The Gambler. The Gambler.
Yes. So, are we... Stefan hasn't answered the question, will the European Union survive? And I wasn't expecting him to. He did say there are no neat solutions, and that's quite clear from your discussion. However, I thought it was a very interesting comment that you made, that your perception is that saving the European Union would be preferred to saving Euro. I think was that a fair assessment of what you're saying?
Yes, perfect. I'd
like to come to the rescue, if I may, of Belgium. At one stage in your talk, you suggested that the European Union, I think, might disintegrate into a Belgium. Having spent a very pleasant week in Bruges last year, and been aware that the Belgians feel they cop it a lot for their situation, although you did deal with that later on. But thank you very much. It was a very interesting and, I think, engaging talk, and we're very grateful to you. Thank you very much.